The purpose of this talk is sort of just to make sure that everyone is on the same page for the rest of the workshop. So
please turn your
microphone.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
So the purpose of the talk is to make sure that everyone is on the same page. So some of you are coming from a classical background, like classical LDPC code. I guess most of you are coming from quantum code. So I just want to maybe set some terminology that everyone will be obliged to use for the rest of the week. So so feel free to interrupt at any time to ask questions, because that's the purpose of the talk. And also feel free to jump in and say, well, maybe you should also mention this and that, because otherwise I don't have material to fill 45 minutes. So I won't tell you where I prepared the talk, but it's on my phone. Okay, so I'll start with just classical code. So classical linear codes are specified by some parity check equation. So we're working on binary field. X is a binary string. This is a K by N matrix, binary matrix, and the set of solution to this equation defines some classical error correcting code. So LDPC code are just a special code, a special case of such linear code where the parity check matrix here is row and column sparse. Okay, so a good way to represent such a code is with its Tanner graph. So the Tanner graph is a bipartite graph that represents the rows and column of the parity check matrix. So if you prefer, you have some check nodes that I represent by square, and some bit nodes. There are more bits than checks. And then you have an edge whenever the ith column has a one in the jth row. Okay, so maybe, okay. So how should you read this matrix, this graph? Well, the code words are all the binary strings that you can assign to these bits down here, such that the parity of any given check is even. Okay, so this bit plus this bit plus this bit should be 0 mod 2, and so on. Okay, so it's here in this case, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I have 9 bits and 4 checks. So how many solutions are there to these equations? There are 2 to the 9 minus 4 equals 2 to the 5. Okay, so the number of solution to this these set of linear equation is simply the number of bits minus the number of checks, assuming here that the checks are not redundant. Okay, so in terms of this matrix, it means that the rows are not linearly dependent, for instance, or if you prefer that, you know, there's none of the parity here that you can obtain by combining other parities. So, so in other words, the code here encodes 5 bits. Okay, it has their 2 to the 5 solutions, so there are 2 to the 5 code words in the codes as if it had 5 bits in it. Okay, yeah, so we will talking about, we often talk about the check degree, so that's the largest degree, usually, of the check. So here the check degree would be 4, because this guy has check degree 4, and you can also talk about the bit degree. In this case, I guess it would be 2, okay? So some codes have a uniform degree distribution, and this is clearly not an example of that. Okay, this is one that where the degree is not uniform. So, if it's a sparse code, these things have to be a constant that don't grow as the code size grows. All right, so that's for classical LDPC. All right. So now let's just talk about quantum code. So generally, these are just a subspace of the Hilbert space. So you would have, let's call it Q. It would be a subspace. So it's the set of state that are annihilated by some projector, or let's say eigenstate of some, plus one eigenstate of some projector, okay? So I would say this is the most general definition. So it's just a subspace of the Hilbert space. So this would be the most general setting, but of course, most of the time we'll be talking about stabilizer codes. And these are defined by, again, a subspace, but the point is that the subspace is specified efficiently. So psi are the plus one eigenstate. So you have a set of stabilizer generator. So these are element of the Pauli group. They mutually commute. So in other words, they are tensor product of the three Pauli matrices, X, which is 0, 1, 1, 0, Z, which is -1, 1, -1, 0, 0, and the quantum information scientist Y, which is 0, minus 1, 1, 0. You might want to put an I there if you want. Okay, so if you take tensor product of these matrices, such as X tensor, you can have identity tensor Y, and so on. These are what we call Pauli operators, and these guys should be commuting element of the Pauli group. Now, the things you absolutely must know about the Pauli matrices is that they all square to the identity, and they either commute or anti-commute. And so, for instance, X times Z is equal to minus Z times X. And if you want to know if whether two operators commute or anti-commute, such as maybe this string, I will always drop the tensor product notation. All you need to do is count the number of locations where they're not the same and they're not the identity. So one, two, okay. So the did everyone get that? These are the only two locations where they're not the same. So here they're the same, or not the identity. And if that number turns out to be even, they commute. If it's odd, they anti-commute. Okay, so that's pretty much all you need to know about the Pauli group in order to understand stabilizer codes. Okay. So here again, so this is very similar to the parity check equation defining a classical code. So if we have n qubits, and n minus k linear independent and you have n minus k, this will mean that the dimension of q will be 2 to the k. Okay, so it will encode k qubits. So it's the same thing as here. You have every linear equation, every independent linear equation from the Pauli group kind of cuts the Hilbert space in half, exactly like in this case here. I guess the last thing about stabilizer code you need to know is that the minimum distance.
You want to mention that S is commute.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. So these stabilizers, generally, if you have a bunch of operators that do not commute, it is not clear that they can share common eigenstates. So, and in the case of Pauli operators, they do not. So you want to insist that these guys mutually commute to define a code. Right. Okay. So maybe just a little bit about error detection and error correction. So if you start with a state psi, which is in the code, and let's say that there's an error which results in the state phi, and this is obtained starting from psi and applying an error. So here we will assume that the error is an element of the Pauli group. There's a justification for this. Essentially, the Pauli matrices span all the matrices. So if you can combine each one of, if you can error correct each one of them, you could correct every error. But of course, this will never happen. You can only correct low weight errors. So the weight of an error, so this is a Pauli element of the Pauli group. And the weight of an error is equal to the number of non-identity tensor component. So this thing has weight 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And this one has weight 4. Okay. Okay, so you apply an error. Now what you're going to do, initially the state, had you measured the stabilizer generator, you would have obtained the eigenvalue plus 1 for each of the measurements. Now, you want to test, is this still a plus 1 eigenvalue of the stabilizer generators? Well, if you apply E to the state phi, that's S applied to E psi. And now there can be two possibility, either E and S commute or they anti-commute. As I said, Pauli matrices can only commute or anti-commute. So this will be equal to plus E S J psi or minus E S J psi. So that's if E S J equals 0, and that's if E S J equals 0. And in fact, let me just go sideways like this. You see that this is S is annihilated by psi. So this gives you phi, and this gives you minus phi. Okay? So in other words, when you measure the stabilizer generators after the error, you get results plus 1 or minus 1. And these tell you whether the error that occurred commuted or anti-commuted with the stabilizer generator. Okay, so, and these plus or minus one measurement outcome are called the error syndrome. And now what you must do is figure out what was the error conditioned on the error syndrome, and that part is called decoding, okay? And I will talk about how decoding is done specifically for LDPC code a bit later. Okay.
It just might be worth mentioning, because whenever you tell this to somebody who doesn't know a lot of quantum mechanics, when you measure this, it collapses the state into one of these eigenspaces.
Except so, it won't happen in this setting. I mean, that's right. Had this been a general error, like one that is not a Pauli error, generally you would end up with a state which is a superposition of such states, and the measurement would actually collapse it onto a subspace with a well-defined syndrome. But if you stick to Pauli errors, this is never going to happen. I mean, you're always in one of the well-defined space. But yeah, that's sort of why we can get away with only treating Pauli errors. Okay. I wanted to talk about minimum distance. Sorry. So an error would be undetected if it commutes with all the stabilizers. So it would return the syndrome plus one, so you would think that you've not left the code space. Well, and that would be a right thing to think. You've not left the code space, but let's say that there exists E, or let's say that, well, yeah, E psi equal psi prime, and this one is in the code space, okay? So that's what it means, or if you prefer, an error that commutes with all the stabilizer generators, such a thing would be an undetected an undetected error. So there are two types of undetected errors, some that are harmless and some that are harmful. So what would be a harmless one? Well, it would be an element of the stabilizer group itself. So if E happens to be a product of the SJs, well, since the SJs mutually commute, it would also commute with the SJ. And but on the other hand, it leaves, where have I written this? It leaves psi invariant, okay? It leaves every code state invariant, so it doesn't do anything to the encoded information. So the thing we have to worry about are the errors that are undetected but do not act like the identity, okay? So undetected harmful error. So they're defined by this condition, ESJ equals zero, and E is not an element, is not generated by the SJs. Okay? And the minimum distance of a code that we call D, I'm going to switch. Sorry? Yeah. Thank you. Minimum distance D is simply equal to the min, the minimum. This weight of an undetected harmless error, harmful error. Okay. So these are the parameters of a code. You have the number of qubits that are used, you have the number of encoded qubit, and you have the minimum distance. And we usually denote them by these double brackets. Okay, so that's, I think, all I have to say about general stabilizer codes. Probably need to speed up too. Okay, so now let's talk about quantum LDPC codes. Well, generally, so this is the most general definition of a quantum code. So I guess you'd want to define them by such an equation, but where this projector is generated by local projectors, okay? So maybe something like this. Q is equal to the set of states such that pi j psi is equal to psi for all j. And these guys are projectors acting on at most a constant number of qubit.
So David,
uh-huh.
Q
I don't know. I mean, it would make sense. You could have a bunch of just binary equations. They don't need to be linear. And saying these binary equations need to be zero. It makes sense. But I mean, has it been studied or so on?
You are calling these operators projectors.
Yeah.
I think it's not right because projectors have zero and one eigenvalues.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, okay. It's not the same as this here. It's more like this one here. This was a projector. Maybe I can turn this equation into a projector by defining pi j equals 1 plus sj over 2. So what Leonard is saying is that, something else I forgot to say about Pauli matrices is that their eigenvalues can only be plus and minus 1. So this is the projector onto the plus 1 eigenstate. And so these would now be projectors. And if it was a plus 1 eigenstate, you would get the same equation. So this is a bit of a kind of discrepancy between these two definitions. Right. But I mean, in fact, this minus 1 is kind of irrelevant, right? It could be 3, it could be 7, it could be pink. It's just like two labels for the different subspaces. And here, so I'm just defining this with local projectors. I guess this is sort of closer to physics notation, where you have some constraints that you want to impose on the system. You might even want to think about a Hamiltonian, which would be minus the sum of these projector. And now you would be like in the ground state of a Hamiltonian. So, so the point is just that you might want to define the code by a bunch of local constraint this way, okay? So a good example of this maybe is the Levin-Wen models for topological order, which are defined by a bunch of local projectors. So each qubit is acted upon by a small number of constraint, and each constraint acts on a small number of qubits, okay? So that would define, that I guess would be the most general definition of what a quantum LDPC code is.
A question.
Yes.
These codes are subsets of less codes.
This is outside. So the law here, I've tried to define quantum codes the most generally as I could, just as a subspace of the Hilbert space, not necessarily stabilizers. Here I've defined stabilizer codes. Now I'm saying quantum LDPC could also be different from stabilizer code. Okay. They're not common, but I mean, there exist examples. And I think Steve will talk about another example at this workshop. The point is that stabilizer code, I mean, usually is referred to, it's when the projectors are made of Pauli matrices, we call them stabilizer. But you could pick another basis of operator to define quantum codes. So there's no reason to restrict to projectors that are made this way with this as a Pauli matrix. Does that make sense?
You'll give some complete examples.
This could be some set of commuting projectors, each of which act on some constant number of qubits.
Yes. Not necessarily.
Do they even need to commute?
Well, I didn't want to go down that way, but sure. I mean, you could say that the ultimate definition is a ground space of a local Hamiltonian. That's what a quantum LDPC code is.
But there's also usually a second condition, right, for LDPC codes, which is that each qubit.
Yeah, I said that, but I didn't write it down.
Yeah,
it's recorded.
Okay.
Projector acting on at most a constant number of qubits, and each qubit acted upon by at most constant number of projectors. Yes.
So, but you really think that we should go to the extreme of considering, like, you know, grounded state of, like, But then, I mean, I don't think that would be very unoperative.
I mean, I think that the problem if you do this is that generally there will not be an efficient scheme for syndrome extraction. But you also know that there are exceptions to this, right?
But then, I mean, would it make sense to talk about the syndrome?
Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying. I mean, like, the subsystem color codes, you can view them this way. I mean, they have sparse, and then you can ask, what about the Bacon-Shor code? Is that an LDPC code? Well,
but
that's
in these cases, the thing is that you have, you know, well, the notion of syndrome. If you just give me like a Hamiltonian, right, then why should there be a notion of syndrome? I think you take
well,
too much of a string.
Well, stick around for Steve's talk.
Still, no, I think that case is, in that case, I can see it because, you know, you have some projectors, right?
Yeah.
But in general, if you just say, I think that's wrong. I think you should keep the notion of syndrome.
That's a matter of this. Yeah, I sort of agree. I don't see any reason to go, you know, beyond that, but
so you can
I want to keep an open mind.
State energy. And if it's zero, then you're in the code space. Stop.
Yeah, you could do error correction.
I'm
with,
not saying it's
yeah.
Zero, but the other, I think the other important thing to add is that, you know, these things, like we tend to have a notion of sparsity in our heads, but there's also a notion of sparsity with respect to the error models that we're considering. And if you do choose to define these things as ground states of Hamiltonians, you run into this other issue that you might have a gapless model.
All right.
And then, you know, all bets are off because you're going to have long-range correlations, and it's not so clear that it really makes sense to talk about correcting local errors or flow-rate errors or things like that. So I really like this definition, but I think we should, and I think if you know what you're doing, you can then port that over to local Hamiltonians, but you should be really cautious.
Sure, yeah. In fact, you could even use like a sparse Hamiltonian as your definition. Why not?
Yeah.
And the point, as you're saying, you can error correct by doing quantum phase estimation. So, but good luck with that.
Is Bacon-Shor called LDPC?
Well, no, because I didn't write. In this example, these were commuting projectors. So Bacon-Shor would not be. But I ultimately, this is semantic, and I mean, I don't care if you call it LDPC or not, but I think it's an interesting example to consider. Okay, so enough about this. So most of us are interested in stabilizer LDPC code. Which are like that, you know, but with these being one plus a Pauli operator, okay? pi j is equal 1 plus sj over 2, where these are commuting Pauli operators. Or if you prefer, it's just a stabilizer code where each element of the stabilizer group acts on a constant number of qubits, and each qubit is acted upon by a constant number of element of the stabilizer group.
Each generator.
Each generator, yes, thank you. That's crucial, of course. Okay, so for these code, it makes sense to define a Tanner graph, which I will now do. And I will actually try to use this Tanner graph later in the talk, so let me get it right. Okay, so it will be a very simple one. I have only three checks and six bits. yep. It's not a great code. This looks like the Tanner graph of a classical code, but what you would do is you would just decorate it with Pauli matrices. So suppose that this check here is X tensor Z. Well, you would put an X on this edge, an X on this edge, and a Z on this one. And then this one could be, for instance, X. Let me put Z here. If I put Z, what needs to go on this edge?
Zero.
Which?
X.
Is that it?
Or Y.
X or Y, okay. Everyone's on board. And then this one has to be the same. Okay, and so on. Okay, so you can easily check with the rules that I gave that this would be a valid stabilizer code. I mean, they commute. It's a pretty lousy one, but nonetheless a stabilizer code. So that's the tanagraph for a quantum code. It's a good way of specifying the code. And then there's a special class of stabilizer code, which are CSS, quantum LDPC. So in this case, all that it means is that there are two types of stabilizers, stabilizer generators. Are all X, and, well, I'm not saying this right, and Z. Well, let me just write this. So I mean, some of the stabilizers contain only X, and some of the stabilizers contain only Z. And that's what defines a CSS code. The two set of generators could be the same up to this basis change, but they don't need to. You could have quantum CSS code that come from two different stabilizer codes. Okay, so now the orthogonality condition becomes kind of simpler. So you have some operators. So you have S, X, J. Let's write with a short notation like this. U, V, J, and S, Z, K is equal to Z to the U, K. So this is, I mean, these are all only binary strings. I hope that, so essentially binary, this is a sparse binary string and it says that put X's where there are ones and identities where there are zeros. And now the condition is simply that VJ UK is equal to 0 mod 2 for all J and K. This is the the commutativity condition becomes an orthogonality condition. So often we view U and V as defining classical codes, and these codes have to be orthogonal. Okay. Now here's something extremely important. If you view the V's here as the parity check matrix of a classical code, this equation is telling you that the code has a lot of low-weight code words, okay? Because this matrix, these checks are sparse, which means that these are sparse vectors, and this is the equation for a code word. So all the UKs would be small code words of the code VK. So if you want to think of CSS codes as coming from two classical codes, they are bad classical codes. You need bad classical codes to define a quantum code via this CSS formalism. So is that clear? LDPC, yeah, absolutely.
Just one more time, so why does one have to be bad?
Okay, so let's look. So this is the definition of a classical code. Let's say that I think of H as being made up of these V1, V2, V, whatever, S. Okay? This equation here is the equation for being in the code. Okay? But remember, we want both of these to be sparse if we want this to be a quantum LDPC code, which means that this code contains a lot of short strings. So it has a small minimum distance. Okay. So that will be a problem later. Okay. We got the CSS. Okay, so an example. here is so here I have my check nodes. And here I have my bit nodes. And so on. And I will decorate in this way. Is that right? Am I doing this right? No, I'm not doing. Sorry?
Do the other squares with C's?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to do.
That could work.
No, they're not touching. Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, sorry. I wasn't reading this right. Okay. So and so on. So this pattern. Can anyone guess what it is? It's the pantograph for the toric code. Okay. I guess figure this out. Well, no, I mean this is an important example. You're not used to seeing it this way. Usually, you define it not on the tantograph, but only on the lattice of qubits. But this is the tantograph, and it says like, you know, if you look at this check and this check, do they really commute? Yes, because they overlap at this location, and so that's an even number of anti-commutations, so they commute, and so on. Okay, right, I guess you'll hear a lot about the toric code this week, and that's its tantograph. Okay, so these were, okay. Before I talk about decoding, there's one last thing which I need to talk about, and it's degeneracy. I'll talk about degeneracy in general, and then show you how it affects sparse codes. Oh, not doing well on time. Okay, so degeneracy. Okay, so if you have two errors, E and F, and let's say that F is equal to E multiplied by an element of the stabilizer group, so something that is generated by the SJ. Well, if we look at the syndrome equation, which is up here, remember that the syndrome measures whether the error E commutes or anti-commute with each stabilizer generator. But S commutes with everything in there because this is an abelian group. So you can easily convince yourself that S and E have exactly the same syndrome. Okay. So when you're going to measure your syndromes, it is impossible to tell these two apart, okay? Impossible to tell E and F apart by their syndrome. On the other hand, this is not such a bad thing because let's suppose that you know you start with a code state, you pick up an error, and you diagnose that it was F. Okay, as I said, you can't tell them apart. So you get the syndrome and you say, oh, it must have been F. And now you're gonna correct with F. This was the state with the error. You apply the correction F, and what you leave behind is S psi, and that's equal to psi. Okay, so it's all right. So that's the kind of positive side of degenerate errors is that you don't need to identify exactly the error. In fact, there's kind of a coset which is obtained by the stabilizer group. And you just need to identify which coset the error came from. It's not necessary to identify exactly the exact identity of the error itself. Anything in the same coset will do. Now, in LDPC code, this will happen all the time. The reason for this is that usually, you will have errors of small weight occurring on your system. And so usually you would kind of look for the smallest error that's compatible with the syndrome. And you'd say, well, that's likely to be what has occurred. But now here, since the stabilizer generator are sparse, you can multiply a low weight error by a stabilizer and it will remain roughly of the same weight. So there are many, many low weight errors that will be compatible with your syndrome. So this mistaken diagnostic will happen very often, but it shouldn't be a problem in general. But as I will show you, with existing decoding algorithms, this will be a problem, okay? And that's the last thing that I would like to talk about. So let's return. So now what I want to explain is how to perform belief propagation decoding of classical and quantum LDPC codes. So let's use this Tanner graph simply as the Tanner graph of a classical code. And let's use it on the erasure channel to get started.
Is that what you're doing now?
Okay, so I'm going to erase these positions. Sorry. I'm going to erase these positions. So here I could put 0, 1, and 1. And what I want you to do is tell me what should be at these locations. I might need some extra time.
1, 0, 1.
Does everyone agree with that? So, while those who do agree have probably ran belief propagation in their head, okay? Because like, if you'd ask to intuitively solve this problem, you'd come up with the belief propagation algorithm because it's so simple. So let's see how people did this. Okay, so initially, this will be a message exchange between the bits and the check. So initially, every bit sends a message that just tells the check what's their value. So the value can be 1, 0, or a question mark. This one receives 2 question mark, 1. Okay, so these are the messages going from the bits to the checks. Now, each check receives some messages, 0, 1, question mark, but it knows that whatever the bits were, they must sum up to 0 mod 2. So this check knows that the only possibility here is a 1. Okay? What about this check? What have I done? Yeah. It receives 1 question mark, question mark. It doesn't know. Okay? It could be 1, 0 or 0, 1. Doesn't know. And here, same thing. It could be 1, 0 or 0, 1 again. So now in the next round, the check will send messages to the bits. And the if it received, a non-erasure, it will just send back the same message. But for instance, here, we've learned that this was a 1, right? So this is the messages we're going to check. The outgoing messages here are actually the same as the incoming messages, so I'm not going to erase them, okay? So now in this round, we've learned this value here. Okay, we've learned that this was a 1, and we just iterate. Now, you're going to have these messages going out. This time, this one's going to change into a 1, okay? Now, this guy gets 1, 1 question mark, so it knows that this question mark must be a 0. So it sends out these messages. You've learned a 0 here. I'm going a bit fast here, but then in the next round, here you'll be sending a 0. you get 0?1, this must have been a 1, and that's it. Okay, so it's just these iterations. Simple enough? Okay, now what if it wasn't the erasure channel, but some other channel, such as the binary symmetric channel? Let's forget about the bit value. Let's say that you measure the syndrome, and you see that this one gives you +1, as it should. This one may be -1, and this one, I don't know, -1 as well, whatever. I'm not going to perform belief propagation in front of you, because it gets a bit trickier. I'm just going to tell you what the rules are, okay? So essentially, here at the beginning, you have a probability vector, which is sort of like 1 minus p, p. This is the probability vector at every bit, and it just represents, you know, this is the probability that I have not been flipped, and this is the probability that I have been flipped. So each bit is going to send a message, which initially is simply this prior probability, okay? So message from bit to check, and let me put a 0 here, is equal to this probability vector, this prior. This 0 means the first iteration, okay? Now I need to tell you message from the check to the bit at time t. Well, this is, again, very, very intuitive. What's going to happen is that a given check has received many, many incoming messages, and essentially, locally, all it does is that it applies Bayes' rule, okay? So suppose that you know what's the probability that this one is 0, you know what the probability that this one is 0, and you want to compute what's the probability that this one is 0, okay? Well, that's easy. I mean, you can compute this from Bayes' rule, okay? So it would simply be the probability that this one is 0 is the probability that these two are 0 plus the probability that these two are 1. Everyone get that? Okay. So how can I write this in an equation? So this would be for a certain value of the bit. So let's compute the probability for this one being 0, let's say. This will be the product over all the bits that are coming that are adjacent to C, except B itself. So you don't want to take the message that came from this one when you're sending out a message to that one. And then it would be the message coming from B prime to C, value of Y, and YB, yep. And now you are going to sum over all the value of Y, and you're going to put a delta, Y, X, Y hex, I'm going to use the sloppy notation, have right parity. So let me explain what I mean here. So essentially, you want to sum over all the bit string that give you the right parity. This parity might be +1 or -1, depending on the check. Okay. So you want the value of the bits of the combined x that you're trying to compute and y's to add up to the right probability. That's all you're asking. Okay. So that's the that's how you compute the outgoing messages at the checks. And then there's a similar equation from the bits to the check. I mean, the message going from the bit to the check. Oh, and these are obtained at time t minus 1, of course. Okay, so it's the messages that you've just received. You combine them and compute an outgoing message. This will be very similar. So, I mean, again, it's just local Bayes' rule. So if you know the value of this bit and you want to compute the value of this probability, of this bit, this will simply be your prior times the message, the product over the check that are adjacent to a bit accept the check you're sending, message T minus one, check to B. Okay, so the detail of this equation is not extremely important, but the logic is just that you apply locally Bayes' rule. Okay, so you treat these incoming messages as probabilities, and once you know the probability, the marginal probability of each of these bits, and you want to compute, well, given this parity constraint, what's the probability of this bit? You just locally use Bayes' rule and you send that message out. So that's all there is to it. Okay, use locally Bayes' rule and exchange messages. Okay, and so at the end of the day, you get all these incoming messages, and we define a belief. Belief of bit B is equal to the prior X multiplied by the product of all the incoming messages of the incoming messages. Okay. Again, it's just like you have a prior here and two incoming probabilities. You just take their product and you say at time t, this is my belief. Okay, and you will. The decoding, you simply pick the bit value with the highest probability locally. Okay, that's how the decoding works. Now, just a few words about this. I realized that I was kind of fast. How would this work for Pauli? If you had Pauli strings instead of just bit string, exactly the same way, okay? You start with a probability vector over the four Pauli matrices. Here you have some local constraint on what the Pauli matrices, the incoming Pauli matrices can be, given by the commutativity constraint. So you just locally use Bayes' rule, okay? So you have three incoming probability vectors, you have a global constraint, what's the probability of this Pauli element, and you just use Bayes' rule. So it's the same idea. So that's not a problem. So what is the problem when we use belief propagation with stabilizer code? And maybe I can end with this. Is that belief propagation is fundamentally a marginal decoder. Okay. Belief propagation is a marginal decoder. By this, I mean that what you're trying to compute ultimately, like there are issues with belief propagation when there are loops and so on, but forget about that. Even if the belief propagation gave you an exact answer, what you obtain at the end of the day is local probabilities. Okay, what's the probability that there was an X here? What's the probability that there was an X here, a Y here, a Z here, and so on? And if a code is degenerate, there's no reason for these things to be peaked, okay? And the best example that I can give is with the TORC code. So the marginal decoder, these are not peaked in a sparse code, a sparse quantum code. So think of the TORC code. Suppose that you have two syndromes that are like this, okay, diagonal to each other. There are two errors that are consistent with this syndrome, this error and this error. Okay, these are the smallest weight error that are consistent with this syndrome. So if you look marginally, okay, the probability distribution everywhere will be the same. Okay, so belief propagation will tell you that the right correction for this is to apply all four errors, okay? But you know that this is not right. I mean, you could apply these two, or you could apply these two, but not all four. So belief propagation, just by symmetry, the marginal probability here, 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 and here will look the same. So either it will tell you, like, do nothing, or do all four of them, but it can't pick between them because of the symmetry of the problem, okay? And this is what will happen typically, and ultimately the problem is that you're using a decoder with a bad classical code, Okay, it's a code that has a very, very small minimum distance, so you don't expect it to converge, and this is exactly what's going on here. Marginal probabilities are not peak. So I mean, a physical analogy is like if you have a ferromagnet, like Ising ferromagnet, and you compute local magnetization, but you don't look at correlations. Okay, so you're going to cool down your system and measure this bit, and you say, oh, it's pointing up, and then you're going to heat it up, cool it down, measure the other bit, oh, it's pointing down. And then you're going to try to estimate the ground state this way, okay? So of course you're going to get something random. You have to look at correlations, okay? Otherwise, just marginally, you have no information. And this is exactly what's going on here. As any algorithm which only looks at local probabilities will fail for quantum LDPC code. And sort of that's all we got. So this is why there's a problem with this. Okay, so yeah, I guess this is a good place to stop. So I'll take more questions if you ask.
My dad disappoints people.
Andrew.
So you probably talk to more classical coding theory people than I do. Have you ever come across anybody that's said this degeneracy problem shows up in classical decoding in any sense that's relevant?
Well, here's the thing. If you believe that a global decoder, like the maximum a posteriori, is peaked, then the locals are peaked, right? You can't, I mean, sure, there can be, it can be less peaked, but it should be peaked. So I don't think it would come up, but I mean, we have classical coding theorists here, so maybe they can answer. But maybe, I mean, there is a problem with belief propagation in classical LDPC as well. They're responsible for the error floor. Certainly it's caused by the fact that, you know, these probability are not peaked enough. Let's say that you have a probability distribution on an n bit string, which is really peaked around one element, okay? And you take marginal on the first qubit, let's say. This marginal could be peaked. I mean, it could be much broader, right? Because you're adding up 2 to the n things that have tiny contributions, but these things can add up. So, I mean, that could be responsible. But the point here is that even this global thing is not peaked. There's no reason for it to be peaked. It should assign like equal weight to all the degenerate errors. So we don't expect the maximum a posteriori to be peaked, so even less so the marginals. So I think it's a greater problem in the quantum case.
What do you mean by peaked?
Yeah, okay. I just mean like a probability which is very close to one on only one element and near zero on all the other ones. So again, I mean, if you have the probability vector on all 2 to the n bit string, this thing can be sharply peaked on one element, okay, like let's say the all zero bit string. But then if you look at the marginal probability on the first bit, it can have quite a bit of weight on the on one, on the element one, right? Because all these 2 to the n things can add up.
But this doesn't converge to just two peaks, it's like converges to one peak.
Sorry, but in this case, it's even worse because, like, if you look at all the errors that are consistent with the syndrome, the lowest one would be this one and this one, and they have exactly the same probability. So, like, to be concrete, let's say that these were Plaquette. This would be XX error, and this would be XX error. So the two vector XX identity and identity XX have exactly the same probability. So now, if I look only on the first qubit, X and identity have the same probability, right? So it's the point is that you're starting from a broad global probability, so surely the marginal will not be peaked. Yes?
Suppose we have a classical code to this slow weight checks, but each bit can potentially belong to many checks.
Yeah.
Can you still apply the leaf propagation decoder?
Good question.
It looks like you can efficiently implement it.
Yeah. Okay. So let me give kind of a hand waving. It's not a problem with implementing it. The problem is that the information that comes in from the check gets extremely diluted when you send it back to the when it comes into the bit. I mean, again, we've discussed this before. It's like if you have, you know, if you have very strongly biased coins, and you toss like a thousand of them, and you say, I know that the result is odd, and I look at the what's the probability of one bit? Well, it's still going to be 50-50, right? So, but I guess that explains why it wouldn't work up here. These guys have to be sparse. Down here, I guess a similar argument would apply, that the information coming in from the check, remember this erasure channel that I showed, like you were gaining one bit at a time, right? Yeah, I don't think this could, like, if you have a bit that touches two checks that each have more than one error, you don't get any information, right? In the erasure channel example. And I think that if it was not bit sparse, then you would, this problem would be very typical, so it wouldn't work.
No, I don't, that doesn't seem right, because, I mean, in the erasure channel example, the bit, you learned what the bit was if any of the checks.
If any of the checks. Yeah, I keep doing the reverse. But I mean, first of all, can you have something that is not bit sparse?
You could have one bit that is very coupled.
Just one bit, yeah. But I mean, clearly, if the bits are not sparse, the checks cannot be sparse either.
Well,
I mean, you can have.
You mean if all of the bits are not sparse?
Yeah, if all of the bits are not sparse. Yeah, you could have maybe one bit.
Well, yeah, we're kind of going into my next possibility of government. So maybe we should have a conversation.
Thanks.